Okay, Keith, thank you so much for joining me again. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be back.
I wanted to get you on today to discuss the life and work of the philosopher Daniel Dennett, who sadly passed away in April this year at age 82. And I've invited you on because, of course, you're a philosopher yourself, but you're a good friend of Dan's. So it would be great if you can kind of help us understand Dan's life and work a little bit more. I'm going to kind of go through that that kind of journey with a few questions for you. So after Dan passed away, I saw that you tweeted, you said, "Dan Dennett was a great philosopher, a kind and gentle man, and a dear friend to me and many others. We shall all be poorer without his wisdom, and I shall miss him immeasurably," which is a lovely, lovely thing to hear and say. But yeah, for someone who maybe, kind of especially maybe doesn't know much about philosophy, maybe knows very little, maybe hasn't even heard of Daniel Dennett, I just want to kind of ask as a first question, who would you kind of say Daniel Dennett was? How would you sum him, his career and his life up?
I'd say he was a great philosopher, and I would say he was what you'd imagine a great philosopher should be. He was a great personality, first of all. He was a large man, tall, bearded, impressive. He spoke clearly, slowly, authoritatively. He thought about the deep questions, the big questions of life, about the mind, about our place in the universe, about meaning, about the nature of thought, about the nature of freedom, free will, what it is to be free, what it is to be an autonomous being. Thought about the nature of the self. He thought about religion. He thought about the big questions of life. And he brought he thought about these questions in a big way. So often philosophers can take what seems like a big question and reduce it to some very technical they can formulate it in a rather technical way and address technical aspects of that question, perhaps about the way we conceptualize it and so on, which I think leaves ordinary people feeling cheated a little bit. They think, I wanted to know about the nature of consciousness, and what you're giving me here is this some very detailed analysis of specific claims about consciousness and specific, you're giving me you're taking thought experiments and analyzing them in great detail. And where's the answer? Where's the big picture out of all of this? It's a big question. Where's the big answer? Dan gave us big answers. He had a wide vision. I don't think you do good philosophy just by being skilled in philosophy. You need to know a lot more about life, about science, about life in general, about humanities, about art. You need to have lived well and richly to be able to think about philosophical questions. And Dan did live well and richly. He wasn't an ivory tower academic concerned only with academic matters. He was an artist, a sculptor, a musician, a farmer. I'll say more about this later. He was a well-rounded person who thought deeply about the big questions and had important and, I think, true things to say about these big questions. So he was what you want a philosopher to be. Not everyone was persuaded by his view, but I think everyone found it impressive and important and worth listening to. He was what a philosopher should be.
Yeah, it seems like from hearing you speak and all the kind of tributes online that came out after he passed away, that Dan's kind of legendary status and all the respect people have from him is not just his great philosophical work and career, it's him as a person as well. He seems to be just a lovely, very kind, caring respectful person. And the combination of these is what's, I mean, that plus the philosophy, I feel like, has just come together to give him this such great status and high regard for people.
He was generous with his time, particularly to people who, particularly to junior people. He knew his worth. And if people could afford to pay for his time, then I think he would expect them to. But he was very generous with his time with people who needed help, younger people. Tell you a little story again. Last year, a Slovakian graduate student, Katarina Sklutova, was visiting me here in Crete to work with me for a little bit on, she was writing on illusionism. And I think on her last day, we'd been talking about Dan, and she knew Dan's work very well and very highly of him indeed. And on the last day, I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could just get down to talk to her for 10 minutes on Zoom? So I quickly emailed him and said, could you spare, I know it's last minute, there's no notice, but could you spare a few minutes to talk to this person? She'd be really appreciated. And he said, yeah, sure. So just set it up, and he talked to her, listened to her questions, shared his thoughts on the topic she was working on. It's very encouraging. He spoke for nearly an hour, and which was lovely. But then this is a further twist to it, because then Maria came in, and they sort of blew him a kiss, because they were very fond of each other. And he said, "Oh, Maria," he said, "do you know what you've just done? You've just given me a birthday kiss." It was his birthday. He'd taken an hour out of his birthday to talk to someone he'd never met before, but he knew was a junior person who would appreciate this time and would benefit from it. And Katarina's has written a lovely obituary for Dan for a Slovakian journal. So, and you will find, if you talk to people who knew Dan, endless examples of stories like that. I mean, he also had his enemies, people who he thought were poisoning the well, and people who he thought could take the criticism, people who, if he thought people didn't, there's a section in his autobiography on academic bullies, people who he thought were a bad influence in academia. And he had no problem calling these people out. But it was only with people who he knew could take, with people who would give it out, he would be happy to give a bit back, you know, give them a bit of tough talking back. But with people who needed help, he was always supportive.
If you were to look at his whole career, could you talk us through some of what you think have been some of his kind of highlights, his most widely celebrated philosophical ideas or views, like some of the areas he made a lot of progress on?
His first book, which was a development of his PhD thesis, was called Content and Consciousness. And that really got at the two of the central themes of his work. A lot of the seeds of much of his later work were there in that earlier book. I think in that first book, he'd already got the outline of where he wanted to go. And you can see all the rest of his work as developing that, I think. The seeds of it are there in the other. So content is again, part of the manifest image is that we talk about each other as having mental states with content that are about things. You know, he believes that he has dropped his contact lens. He has a belief that's somehow about his contact lens. Somehow the mind has this property of intentionality, intentionality is it's a metaphor from an arrow being directed at something. So that's why the mind can direct itself to things outside itself, which seems a pretty clever thing. I mean, I can just sit here now and think about China, and somehow my mind is directed at China. So this can seem a pretty puzzling thing, if you like. Some people have said that's the distinguishing feature of the mental, that it has this content. It's about mental states, that they are about something, whether they're thoughts, desires, hopes, fears, they're all about something. Even pains can be about state of your own body. So how does that work? Because again, if you turn to a neuroscientist and say, you know, which of the properties of the brain make it about some, make the states about something? Well, and they might say, well, that region seems to be involved in detecting faces or something, or that major may be involved in processing, but how in processing language, but how those bits, that those neurons, that the pattern, those arrangements of assemblies of neurons that the neuroscientist pointed to, how those get to be about something, that seems like a question that's that the neuroscientist doesn't really have the resources to answer. So some people think that intentionality, this property of being about things, is kind of, it's not like a fundamental property. Brains just somehow produce this property, and we just have to accept that they do it, and that's it. So that the scientific image is incomplete. Similarly with consciousness, again, consciousness involves awareness of things, being able to detect and classify things around you, but it also seems to involve some inner life, inner feeling, that again doesn't seem to be captured in the language of neuroscience. So these are two big issues that were central to Dan's work. Much of his work in the 1970s was on intentionality. And then in the 1980s, he wrote a book. Another one is Free Will, of course. Again, we seem to have this ability to initiate courses of action in ourselves in a way that's not completely constrained by prior circumstances. It seems we can just make up our minds to do something and thereby change the course of events. We can initiate action. Okay. And again, the neuroscientists will tell us about the processes that are involved in decision-making, but where does this sort of spark of freedom come from? Because all the processes that the neuroscientists will point to will themselves have prior causes in the brain or in the stimulation that the brain receives. So, you know, all these cases, there seems to be this extra ingredient. So the 1980s, Dan wrote a book on free will, Elbow Room. And he continued to write on intentionality, but he also started writing more about evolution and about animal cognition. Then in the 2000s and the 1990s, he wrote a big book about consciousness, Consciousness Explained, which continued to be a theme of his work right through. He then wrote a big book about evolutionary theory, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, a wonderful book. I haven't said anything about evolutionary theory, but that was the key to unlocking, I think, this new perspective for Dan. He was a naturalist. He wanted to show how we could explain these puzzling phenomena in natural terms without taking things like free will or consciousness as being fundamental. Supposing that consciousness is fundamental is, he used the term a skyhook. A skyhook is like something that you want to lift something up in the air. So imagine just hanging it from a hook that's hanging from the sky. Well, yes, that would do it, but you don't explain how the hook got there. Okay, so you hang it from the hook, and that's how that thing, but where's the hook hanging from? And he thought that taking puzzling things like consciousness or free will or intentionality as fundamental as saying the brain just has this property, that's a skyhook. You're saying, really, no, it has it, and yeah, we can explain things in terms of that, but we can't explain how it got it. And Dan's slogan was that you should replace skyhooks with cranes, where a crane is an explanatory device. It's a way of hanging things in the air, but it's grounded. It's itself. Its own existence can be explained. Okay, it's not a magical thing hanging from nothing. It's a structure that's built up from the ground, and whose existence you can explain and understand. And that, so he, instead of taking consciousness and free will and so on, as skyhooks, he wanted to develop cranes that could explain them. And the crucial crane building thing was evolutionary theory. So then there's a big book on evolutionary theory, which was central to underwriting this naturalistic picture that he was developing. Now, for a lot of the 2000s, it was a lovely book on another little book on consciousness in the early 2000s. Then he spent quite a lot of time writing about religion. That's when he became associated with one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. As part of his work, it's been probably less interest to me. I think he did that. I mean, he was interested in, he was again providing a naturalistic account of religion, showing how religion is a natural phenomenon, product of processes of cultural evolution rather than biological evolution. But he was, I think, concerned. I think he saw that work as a kind of bit of public service that he felt he needed to do because of the abuses of religion. He wasn't deeply hostile, I think, to religious people or to religious attitudes as such, certainly not to some of them. But he thought that organized religion could do an awful lot of harm, and a lot of people were being exploited and abused by it. And he wrote a big book, Breaking the Spell, and he devoted a lot of time to fighting what he saw as pernicious forms of organized religion. Though I think of the other horsemen, so that was Dawkins, Harris, and Sam Harris, wasn't it? Christopher Hitchens, he was probably the one who was temperamentally least antagonistic to religion. So there are aspects of religion that, songs, for example, that he was fond of. And then finally, into the 2010s, he moved back, I think, to working on consciousness. Wrote a lovely book, 2017, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, which told the big story, big evolutionary story from the origins of life, the pre-organic origins of life, the pre-organic processes that led to life, right through the story of the evolution of biological evolution into the processes of cultural evolution that helped create the distinctively human mind. And he there brought back something that he used in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which was meme theory as a central explanatory tool in thinking about human culture. Just as genetic theory so the gene is the unit of replication in, well, what's being simplifying, in biological evolution. So the meme, the idea, is a unit of replication in cultural evolution. And he'd been criticized for some of his earlier work on that, but he brought it back and doubled down on it and defended it in Bacteria to Bach and Back. And then, of course, his last big book was his memoir. It was his memoirs, which were published last year, called I've Been Thinking, which is probably, for people who don't know, might be the a good way to approach his work. Now, another excellent way into his work is a collection called Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking, which is a collection of extracts from his work, organized thematically, covering intentionality, consciousness, free will, and so on. Which is a rather nice introduction to his.
Do you know if there's any areas that he didn't have time to get to, or felt that he had a go at but didn't, for some reason, have enough time to focus there more, or felt it actually particularly hard to make progress, or maybe some areas that because of the way the world's changed with technology. You could imagine that he would have tackled if he was to still be thinking about things, you know, 5 years from now.
He was doing this right now. I mean, he was very concerned about some recent developments in AI, in generative AI, the large language models, ChatGPT, and so on. The power that deep learning techniques have to produce simulations of people's speech and thoughts, as you know, articulated in language, and indeed appearance. You could use these techniques to create a counterfeit of a person who would look like them, speak like them, say the sort of things they would say. That could even be passed off as the sayings of that person. He was very worried about this, counterfeit people. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic about this. He thought this was very dangerous. And he was working actively. It was like the religion thing. He saw this as a public duty to speak out on this, and he was putting it ahead of other more philosophical projects. I mean, I was always interested in consciousness and working on that. And we'd been working on something together, but he wanted to speak out on this issue. He thought it was urgent, and he would be doing that right now. This, you know, he'd probably be giving a talk on it this month. You know, it's he thought this was probably the most it was one of the most dangerous threats that humanity faces, that we were going to, the infosphere, if you like, is going to be polluted with misinformation, that these tools are going to be used to generate vast quantities of misinformation, to mislead people, to produce he talked about counterfeiting people. And so that we could imagine living in a world where we just don't know what to trust and what not to trust. And that is very, very dangerous, I think. And he was, so he would have been working on that. He was working on that, and he would have continued doing.
So yeah, having looked at lots of his work and his ideas, begin to touch on a few more questions about kind of, you know, the psychology of Dan Dennett and who he was as a person. So yeah, what do you think it was that drove Dan to work so hard in his career in philosophy? What motivated him to want to think so deeply and explore all these questions?
He had great energy, great enthusiasm, and I think he found the world fascinating. He describes in his autobiography how, as a child, he liked to, I think he was given an accordion at some point, and he wanted to take it apart and work out how the accordion worked. And he worked out that if you rearrange the keys, you could rearrange the keys so that somebody who knew nothing about how to play about music could play a song simply by pressing them in order. This sort of thing. He loved working out. He wanted to know how things worked. He had an engineer's mind in some ways. This is one thing that I particularly liked. He thought that mystery was mysterious things were wonderful, but they were simply an invitation to explore and find out how the mystery how the thing worked. The idea that there was just a mystery and you just had to accept that was a mystery and there it was, that I think he found that rather boring. He wanted to, you know, if you give an engineer something that a sort of black box that does some quite interesting things, they want to take it apart, take the back off, and see how it's doing it. That's how he wanted to approach the world. I think that he wanted to see how it worked. And there was an example I was going to. He tells a nice story about it. He bought a wonderful antique robotic dog in Paris. I think he called it Tatty. It was a wonderful antique. Antique, I guess, maybe in the 40s or 50s. Because he wanted to get it home and take it apart and find out exactly what it was supposed to do and how it would work and try and figure it out. And of course, that's what evolutionary theory is all about, figuring out the mystery. How did all this wonderful design that surrounds us in nature? You see, before Darwin, people like Paley, the theologian, he said, if we found a watch in the middle of the in some isolated part of the some isolated heath somewhere, we wouldn't conclude that it had just arrived there by accident. We conclude that it had been designed by some human or whatever who dropped it there. And similarly, he said, we find all this wonderful design around us in nature. It must have been designed by someone, the great watchmaker. And God, now for Dan, that explanation would be incredibly boring. Yes, there was all this wonderful design everywhere. But to say, oh, somebody just did it, it's just so kind of trivial. How did, even if they did do it, even if there was a God, how did they do it? How did they come up with the plans? How did they manufacture these things? Where did they get the ideas from? That's the interesting, that's the exploration, that's the hunt. And it doesn't diminish the richness of the world, it vastly increases it, because you now see all the wonderful complexity that underlies the complexity. Dan had this quotation he liked to use. He used it very often from a name escapes me at the moment. I'm very sorry. From a writer on magic. Oh, I wish I could remember. I know I've actually spoken to the. Sorry, I can't remember the name. No, but it's. Oh, I'm annoyed because I actually have spoken to the author. Anyway, it was a book on Indian magic. The guy's a professional magician himself, and the quotation goes something like this: the guy says, "I tell people I'm writing a book on magic," and they say, "Real magic," and he would say, no, the sort of magic that is done by artifice and sleight of hand and so on, the sort of magic that you know can actually do, not real magic, where real magic is the sort of magic that actually you can't do, that doesn't happen. But the other sort of magic, the magic that you can actually do, the wonderful effects that you can create by artifice and ingenuity, that sort of magic is so much more fascinating, because it's you can understand how the wondrous effect is created. And so I think Dan saw the world as magical, but magical in the sense of the kind of magic that can actually be done. He wanted to understand how nature created these wonderful effects. And I think that's his view on consciousness too. Consciousness is a kind of wonderful effect that we have, but how is it created? How do natural selection and processes of cultural selection install this wonderful set of processes in our heads that produces this effect that we have of apparently being something like an immaterial Cartesian mind? We don't have to just say, yes, we are that material Cartesian mind. We can say, why does it seem to be like that? How did nature create that impression, and why?
Well, yes, obviously, an understatement to say that Dan is an incredibly deep thinker, but I'm intrigued. As a friend, did you get the sense at all that he brought the same level of deep thinking to his own life at all? To like maybe his relationships, the way he spent his time, how he felt about himself as he was getting older, like obviously these deep personal things you think about yourself. Would you say Dan was also a very deep thinker with regards to these areas as well, his personal life?
People who know more intimately would be better placed to answer that question. So I can tell you my impression. It was more the other way around, that he bring his philosophical attitudes into his everyday life. It was more that he brought his everyday life into philosophy. He did his philosophy in the way that he did his everyday life. By which I mean that he, I suppose this is a bit of a caricature, but there's a lot of truth in it. Many academics live for their academic work. I'm their families too, of course, but their academic work is absolutely central to their identity. And it's the thing they're really good at and a central source of self-esteem for them. Vedana, I think, was a much more rounded character. He'd considered a career as a sculptor. He was a very talented sculptor. He was a talented musician. There's a whole chapter in his autobiography about music, about choral singing, I think, and jazz. I think he played in a jazz band in his youth. He was a sailor. He loved sailing. He spent a lot of time sailing. He was a farmer. He had a farm. He bought a farm. He and Susan, his wife, bought a farm in Maine in the 1970s. And I know they would. They would certainly make, they made cider and he describes in his autobiography he describes how he renovated a barn, how he repaired the barn, the clever tricks he used to renovate this barn. He says in connection with that he learned more from a farmer friend, a neighboring farmer friend who had very little formal education. He learned as much from him as from any academic friends. So he was a practical man. He liked to make things and make a good job of things. Nick Humphrey was a very good friend of Dan's and could tell you, I think, probably more complete answers to these questions, many of these questions, than I could. But in his tribute to Dan, he showed a picture of Dan fitting a washing machine in his kitchen and doing the carpentry and so on to fit the washing machine. Dan loved solving practical problems, making things work, fixing things. And that's the attitude that he brought to philosophy. So it wasn't so much what did his philosophy in affect his private life. It was his human life was reflected in his philosophy. He approached that too with he'd no time for academic philosophy for its own sake. He had this little analogy he used to use. He said, suppose there's a variant of chess, which is the same as chess, except that there's one change to the rules that the king, I think, can move two squares at a time instead of one. And call this chmess. I think there's a pun on mess, that chmess. Now, he said, chmess is a different game from chess. Doubtless, if you study the theory of chmess, there'll be all sorts of different strategies and so on that work, different end games and so on. The end game theory will be totally different or whatever. And just as people have written books and books and books about chess, they could write books and books and books about chmess. And you could spend your whole life doing it, and you could do it very, very well. You could be an expert on chmess, and that would be, it would all be done to a very high standard. The trouble is it'd be pointless because nobody plays that game. And he thought a lot of academic philosophy was a bit like this, that people had focused in on particular aspects of, they'd taken a certain approach to a problem and focused on developing particular aspects to that problem, developing particular puzzles relating to particular aspects of that problem, of that perspective, but had never really questioned whether the perspective itself was worth, was a good one. So he would say this perhaps in respect to, certain dualist, property dualist theories of consciousness. Or say panpsychist theories of consciousness. People spend a lot of time developing the detail of these theories, but he would say that's like studying chmess. It's the whole approach is flawed to begin with, so you're wasting your time. And he thought a lot of academic philosophy was like that. And again, that reflected this practical attitude, pragmatic, I suppose, attitude. So I see his life and his philosophy as completely continuous, completely of a piece. I think Dan the farmer, Dan the philosopher, Dan the sailor, Dan the sculptor, same man, same approach. And I think that's what made him such a good philosopher.
What was your relationship like with him then? He was a friend of yours, and you were obviously inspired by his work and had some similar views and maybe regarded him as a kind of mentor. Yeah, can you talk about your relationship with Dan?
Yes, well, it goes back quite a long way. I'd begun reading his work when I was an undergraduate, and it had always resonated with me. And I always thought, this is the sort of wavelength I want to be on. I'm not sure I always understood it exactly, but I certainly thought this is the the way I want to look at things. This seems to me a way that works. It just worked for me. And the first time I always regarded him as an intellectual inspiration even before I met him. Now, the first time I met him was this was in the mid-90s. It was actually the first time I gave a talk at a proper academic conference, and just to graduate students and so on. I was still a graduate student myself, just starting my PhD. And I gave a talk on language and thought, the relation between language and thought, which is a theme in Dan's work. And it was inspired by some of his work. And he was there at this conference as one of the speakers. And so he heard my talk, and I can't remember whether he asked a question. It's all a little blurry. Andy Clark was also there. He asked a question that was sympathetic. But then later in the conference, I got a chance to talk to him a bit. And I found him to be everything I'd hoped and that he would be. And then he gave a concluding talk at the conference, which the idea was that he would pull together themes from the conference. And he mentioned my paper several times, and so I was in heaven. As I thought, here's my hero, and he's approving of what I did. So I was very excited about that. Curious enough, at that very same conference, there was also present there my future wife, Maria Kosmeli, and we didn't know each other at the time. She was out there comes, and she actually. Dan actually sat next to her at the dinner, and she was very shy, and it was one of her first conferences as well. And she told me later, once we got to know each other, that he'd been really supportive to her. He'd asked her about her work, asked her what she was working on. She said, oh, "I'm working on Davidson." He said, "Why not Quine?" Who was one of his favorite philosophers. And so she remembered that event. She remembered him as being very supportive to her. Again, a young philosopher who was not known at that time. So he'd created on both of us, I think, a very positive impression. And I like to think that that was the start of my relationship with Maria, and that in a way Dan blessed it so because he was there. So that was the start. Now then after that I wrote my PhD really was based on Dan's. It was rooted in a distinction Dan had between belief and opinion, which he'd written a short paper on this in the 1970s, which How to Change Your Mind, which appeared in his collection Brainstorms. But he never really made a lot of that distinction. And I felt there was a lot of potential in it that hadn't been explored. So that's what I tried to do in my PhD. And then early 2000s, that appeared as a book, which I called Mind and Supermind. That's the best title. But anyway, I was very interested to see what Dan thought of it, so I sent it to him. And I've just found it, actually, now the email that he sent back to me. He said he'd not had time to read it all so far, but he said, "It seems to me you've done what I hope to do myself and never found the path to doing, taking the belief opinion distinction seriously. As I said, I thought it should be taken and showing the many implications, improvements of perspective to be gleaned from such a project. And I'm delighted to have you pursue these quarries. And it seems to me so far that you've done the job right." And then a lovely, typically Dan comment. And I'm not just saying that to be nice. if I thought you were poisoning the well by doing the job ill, I'd be very grumpy now. So again, it was terrific encouragement. And so what I was doing then, I felt, was trying to take hints from Dan's work, directions to explore. And you know, it's as if he'd said, look, over there's something interesting. And I thought, I'll go and have a look. I'll go see what I can find. And so I kept on trying to do this. And then gradually my interests moved a bit more towards consciousness. And of course, Dan had written wonderful stuff on consciousness. And so, again, we kept in touch. Dan was he became an academic referee for me, very generous, just after he'd had his serious heart operation in 2006. He was almost just out of the hospital. He wrote a reference for me that helped me to get a grant that I was applying for. But we didn't meet again after that until this cruise in 2014. There's a cruise organized by the Dmitry Volkov and the Moscow State University, the Center for Consciousness Studies there. And Dan was kind enough to invite me along. And so then I got to spend a week, or about 10 days, I think. Well, Maria too, we're partners on right along. And so we spent 10 days there talking about consciousness. And that's when I really got to know him well. And we started a much more closer collaboration, perhaps too strong, or whether we did work together on things. And I wrote this paper on illusionism. Dan wrote a commentary on it. And after that, we kept in touch very regularly, and we corresponded often. And Dan came to visit Maria and me and our family here in Crete, well, with Susan, his wife, in 2018, I think. We took a trip together to China to give a talk at the ASSC there. We presented work together at conference. And so we were pretty close, and pretty much everything that we'd almost daily emails. And so much so that it was a really huge blow. I knew he was, you know, his health wasn't great, but it seemed, and he'd been traveling just a week or so before he died. And so it was a huge blow. I felt, in a way, that I still do feel, that everything I've done in philosophy in some way was done, perhaps I was going to say for him, it was certainly done at his inspiration. And I would discuss everything with him. I would show him drafts of my work, and it feels a bit like the pilot of the ship has gone, and we're drifting a bit. But and I've been trying to address that partly by writing about him and talking about him and doing this sort of thing. So yes, he was never had an official position as my mentor, but he was my real mentor.
Before I ask you one final question, I just wondered if is there maybe one other anecdote you want to share that would maybe help us understand what Dan was like?
It's maybe a little bit indiscreet, so I won't say who the other person involved was, though people will be able to guess. It was from the Greenland cruise, actually, and I overheard I wasn't eavesdropping. I was there standing in part of the conversation. A certain panpsychist philosopher was talking to Dan, and that this person was saying to Dan, look, you know, panpsychism doesn't contradict anything that you believe or that you want to say about the way that the physical world works and the way that evolution works and the evolutionary explanations you want to give and all of that's compatible with panpsychism. Panpsychism doesn't say it doesn't work like that. It just says there's an extra dimension. There's the intrinsic nature of all these processes that you talk about. So there's all these evolved brain mechanisms and so on, which achieve all the effects that you talk about. But there's also this intrinsic nature to them as well. So really all I'm doing is seeking to expand on the kind of work that you do. And you could join us and you could still do everything you're doing, but you have this extra bit as well. And so Dan looked sort of a bit mischievous and said, well, tell me, is there any money for doing this extra work you talk about, this panpsych? Is there any money? Is there any grant money available for that? And so the panpsych said, well, yeah, it's becoming quite popular now. There's quite a lot of funding available for this. And Dan said, well, then it sounds quite attractive because there's no work to do.
Thanks, that's a great one. Okay, as a final question then, yeah, I mean, what I've actually been doing for like the last five episodes or so is ending every episode with the same question for guests, which is, what does it mean to live a good life? And I wondered if, as well as you did know Dan, what would you say, knowing Dan Dennett, being a friend, has taught you about what it means to live a good life?
When I think of Dan, I think of someone with enthusiasm, with interest, with excitement, with passion. Sometimes people call him a denier. They said he denied consciousness. Can't be true. Dan loved, he celebrated the richness of the world, the wonder of the world. He loved that. He was passionate about it. He was continually curious. I think this is someone who lived a rich life, he would say himself that he was lucky in the opportunities he had. But it wasn't just that he had a lot of opportunities, he took advantage of those opportunities. He had many contacts with scientists doing cutting-edge work, and he took advantage of them. He went and listened to them. He would devote time. Right up at the end of his life, he would go and listen to people who were doing interesting work. He was continually learning. He was continually curious. Continually looking outward. Not inward. You know? And I think that's probably this. He said this thing. I'm not quite sure, actually, where he said it. I don't think it's in print, but he did say this thing. The secret to happiness is finding something bigger than yourself and devoting yourself to it. And I suppose that's almost a cliche, but he did that. He was continually interested in hearing about what other people were doing and thinking about how he could incorporate what they were doing with how he could. He was very good at synthesizing things, putting together a big picture. And here's an interesting thing. Quite often, I've read so much of Dan's work, I've thought so much about Dan's work that I would often find myself using a phrase that I thought was mine, and then I would find it in Dan's work somewhere. And I once came up even to those things like drawing diagrams, I would do them in the same way without realizing this. And I'd often write to him and say, have you ever said this before? Because I'm going to say this and I don't know whether you said it. And I've raised this with him two or three times, and he said, I'm absolutely fine with that. Don't worry about it. If you do use the same, it doesn't matter. What's matter is that, you know, it's continuing. If you've taken it up and we're doing something with it, that's great. I'm only too glad that someone is taking it up and using it and continuing with it. So he did see himself, he did see this enthusiasm, this interest as part of a wider thing. And I think that's why he was so keen to talk to younger people and contribute. He didn't see himself as, he didn't, well, this is my impression, again. He wasn't a self-absorbed person. He liked it when people were interested in his work. He liked it when he was invited to talk and so on. But he saw himself as contributing to something much bigger, something much more interesting than his individual life. And he did have a great equanimity. When he talked about death, he didn't seem afraid of it at all. He didn't seem worried. In the very last interview, he said he made some very touching remarks about the hope that when he was gone, people would still remember some of the things he said and find some inspiration in them. And that was the sort of immortality that I think that the only sort that mattered to him. And I think he's achieved it wonderfully. So if I could emulate that, I think I would have lived a good life. And of course, he would have, I haven't said anything, but he would have also said the same about his family. He was devoted to his family. And I think he saw that too as part of the larger ongoing life to which he was contributing. He was, I think anyone who met him was, the word that, he was vital. He was inspiring. He was a force for good in the world.
Well, Keith, thank you so much. That was, it's really lovely to hear some of your stories and your insights. I feel like I've learned quite a lot myself, and hopefully listeners do as well. Yeah, I'm really glad that you managed to have so many lovely times with someone who's originally your hero and then also became a friend. So,
and I would encourage people to read his work, read his autobiography. He, as I said in that little piece I read, he left a lot of himself behind. There's a lot of Dan still here. You can connect with Dan through his work, through his autobiography, through the many, many interviews he did on programs like Closer to Truth and so on, many, many interviews. He's still around. His influence is here with us, and it's a good one. So enjoy it. He's going to shape the discipline of philosophy for generations to come through his followers. And everyone can play a part. This is one thing I didn't get to say, but I think it's very important. You asked me right at the beginning why he was such an important philosopher. Because he didn't just write for philosophers. His great books, big books from the 1990s onwards, were written. Very few philosophers can do this, or have ever done this. Go back to people like Hume and so on before philosophy became an academic profession. He wrote books that for both at the same time, for the general reader and for the academic. They were cited in academic papers, but they were also accessible to the general public. He did philosophy in public with it, and you can take part in that. You don't need to be a professional philosopher to learn from a great philosopher like Dan. Do it.
There's obviously many of his pieces out there. If someone has never read anything of Dan's, is there a particular book or paper or something that you recommend someone maybe starts with?
I think Thinking Tool, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking is a nice, it's kind of selection of bits from his previous books organized thematically. And so that's a nice introduction. So Thinking, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking is a great introduction to the major themes of his work. And his autobiography is good too. There is some introduction to his work in the course of that, though it's more about the kind of man he was. But the two things are so intertwined. But I think I'd probably recommend you start with those.
Keith, yeah, once again, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. Great chat, and take care.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to talk about Dan and talk with you again.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoy The Human Podcast, please consider subscribing. I hope to see you soon.